Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcasts. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm the RCGP e-learning development lead. And today I'm talking to colleague Dr. Sharon Dixon, who is a GP in Oxford. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Thomas.
Great to have you. And we're talking today about women's health and adenomyosis. And as I understand, you've got a background in doing some research in this area.
I've done some work around GPs' experiences of supporting people with possible endometriosis, which meant talking to them about supporting people with period pain and perhaps pelvic pain, which this is very, very relevant to. And I'm currently doing some work focusing around teenagers, young people, and experiences of pain with their periods. But this is very topical and very relevant, and I'm really glad to be able to talk about it today because I think it's quite a fast-changing thing that's coming across my desk daily in my GP work, this kind of ultrasound finding of adenomyosis. So very glad that this is coming more into a spotlight and really glad that we've got an opportunity to think about it a little bit more and what we can think about, what we know about how to support people.
Yeah, absolutely agree, Sharon. And can you just tell us what we might mean by adenomyosis and how that might be similar or overlapping with endometriosis?
That's a very good question. So adenomyosis is endometrium-like tissue, so the kind of the stroma and the cells that have gone backwards into the myometrium. So they're not contained within the endometrial lining, but they've gone through into the myometrium. We don't really know what causes it. There are a couple of kind of dominant theories, maybe that they overlap and that they're relevant simultaneously or differently for different people because it's quite a heterogeneous condition. But the kind of dominant theories are one is about invaginations, so the back penetration of endometrial tissue into the myometrium through the junctional zone, so the endometrium-myometrium junction. And it was always historically thought that that happened perhaps during uterine surgery or pregnancy or labour or with kind of womb contractions or peristalsis. There's also hypothesis about development from malarian remnants. And in thinking about endometriosis, there is the possibility that they share some causal pathways. So that's one of the ways in which they might be connected, is that we wonder whether the things that drive endometriosis development, which are also, there are kind of a number of theories around that and they're similar, might be relevant to the development of adenomyosis. The naming of this gets really complicated. So if you look at the ICD-10 diagnostic scheme, uterine adenomyosis used to be called endometriosis of the uterus, which is a bit of a strange bit of nomenclature, really, because the definition of endometriosis is endometrial tissue outside the uterus. And I think that that has perhaps had a bit of a legacy of confusion. I don't think that's the case on the ICD-11. So hopefully we're going to be able to move away from that. Because while there is some overlap between the conditions, and I think we'll come on to talk about that a little bit more, they are still considered as discrete and separate conditions, albeit possibly with overlapping symptomatology, overlapping potential etiological pathways or causative pathways, and overlapping therapies and overlapping impacts on people's lives. So yeah, a bit of a complicated Venn diagram clinically.
And I think a lot of us might have seen more likely diagnoses coming through from ultrasound scans reporting, and we may touch on that in a bit more detail. So I do think it seems to be more common subjectively in my medical records, but do we know how common we think this condition is?
That's another really good question. So, I mean, I think the bottom line is the one that you said, which is for myself, more commonly than I might have been taught about or thought about at medical school and affecting a different population. And then that's a really critical thing to try and pull out. So do we know what the population prevalence of adenomyosis is? I think is the question you were asking. And I think, to the best of my understanding, the answer to that is no, we don't really know that perfectly at all. We know that in specialist imaging clinics in hospital, the prevalence is between about 20 and 34% has been reported. But of course, those are people in a specialist clinic with symptoms, and we only refer people for pelvic ultrasounds who've got symptoms. Historically, the diagnosis of adenomyosis was a histology diagnosis, so it was made at hysterectomy. So what we understand about who might have it and how often it is and how common it is all predicated entirely within the population who have been referred for and agreed to and have had a hysterectomy. And I think you can't say that that's easily applicable or generalizable back to the population. There's no controls for that, really. I think the diagnosis is also complicated by the fact that there isn't an internationally agreed or unified histological definition. So there's variance between pathologists, or there has been, about what constituted a diagnosis of adenomyosis at histology. So, you know, how much you had to have or what extent the depth of penetration was or what features had to be there. And actually the same is true for imaging-based diagnosis. So there are increasing sets of criteria which are being developed and which are increasingly being used. And there is increasing awareness of this, and particularly around transvaginal ultrasound scanning. And there is a really interesting bit of work from the UK that looked at the number of features of adenomyosis on ultrasound scan and showed a really clear relationship between the extent of documented menstrual pain. And I think that's a really important finding, but there is not a perfect match, or there is not an understanding of how to map what features are seen at ultrasound with clinical significance. So increasing awareness of the fact that it can be diagnosed on imaging. And the really critical thing about that is that we've been given a whole new population in whom we are seeing adenomyosis, which has turned our understanding about who has adenomyosis kind of slightly, I would say, on its head. Because when you were only seeing adenomyosis as a post-hysterectomy histological pathological case finding, then the people who had adenomyosis were the people who had hysterectomy. So it was perimenopausal, postmenopausal people who had really heavy bleeding and had hysterectomies often for that reason. And now we're seeing it increasingly in much younger people, and we're understanding that really significantly there's an association between adenomyosis and pelvic pain, between adenomyosis and menstrual pain or dysmenorrhea, between adenomyosis and painful intercourse, and between adenomyosis and difficulties with getting pregnant. Although these are all really complicated relationships, because of course we refer people for scan in the context of symptoms, which brings me right back to where I started, with this uncertainty about the background level. But I think the most important thing for me as a GP is this recognition that it can occur across the life course in a way that I think we hadn't appreciated, but that is really, really important to understand, that it can be associated really importantly with these symptoms, and that we should factor that in to the decisions we're making about how and when we do tests and what treatments we offer. And I think the last thing I would say about adenomyosis is that there's this really often cited statistic that a third of cases of adenomyosis were considered to be asymptomatic. But I think that there is a question mark about that. And I'm really grateful to Christina Upson and Stacey Missmer for some brilliant epidemiological kind of writing about this. What they reflect on is that statistic, they say, comes from the reason for hysterectomy and kind of retrospective notes reviews from this hysterectomy cohort. And people who had a hysterectomy for something like uterovaginal prolapse, who didn't have documented menstrual pain or menstrual bleeding or pelvic pain or painful sex, were deemed to be asymptomatic. Now, that is extremely uncertain. The fact that it wasn't documented, yep, or they hadn't been specifically asked about it doesn't mean it wasn't there. And when we now look at people who are being referred for scanning, we think that only about 4 or 5% of them don't have symptoms. So I think that's a really important thing to know.
That's a really, really helpful summary. Thank you, Sharon. And you touched quite a bit there on GP initial assessment. So when to think about sort of doing the ultrasound. So as you said, painful periods, pelvic pain, painful sex. And I guess probably, yeah, it depends on our initial assessment when we see the patient around the sort of those common symptom clusters and when we might think about doing an ultrasound, and then that coming back and helping us make that diagnosis. And any other sort of thoughts on that? So are there the kind of common clusters of symptoms patients might present with to primary care?
And they are the reasons why we would do an ultrasound, I think. I mean, I guess the other one is sometimes that is documented, or is certainly written about, is having a kind of bulky tender uterus. And again, but I think all of those are things that we would normally do an ultrasound scan for. But you're absolutely right. What has changed is awareness, training, education, reporting standards in sonography, so that we are increasingly seeing this coming back to us. I think it would be a really important thing to understand. I'm not aware of any observational studies or epidemiological studies that have been done in UK general practice about how often this is now being identified on ultrasounds or encountered in general practice. But my hunch is very much with yours that there's increasing awareness and increasing reporting, and we're increasingly seeing it. So I think it's really important to be thinking about it, but also to recognise perhaps some of that uncertainty. I mean, there isn't a dedicated adenomyosis clinical guideline, for example, a nice one. So it sort of comes in under the symptoms, as you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, so we've seen our patient, we've done a history examination, done the ultrasound, we've got the result back saying possible adenomyosis. I guess then it'd be reassess the patient about the symptoms, how bothersome they are, and then making an initial management plan, which we would for pelvic pain or painful periods.
Absolutely. It's then, where is this person? I guess the critical question is, why did we end up with the diagnosis? So what was the question or the worry or the concern that brought them to us? What are the things that are causing them difficulties now? there's very little qualitative work in adenomyosis, but that there is really speaks to this huge impact that adenomyosis and associated pain and bleeding can have on people. So using it as an opportunity to just go back and really explore how it's impacting on them, what their priorities are, where they're at with maybe things like fertility or pregnancy desire or pregnancy, yeah, kind of personal journey. And so what's important to them? I think thinking critically, so adenomyosis and endometriosis are considered separate conditions, but there is this slightly complicated overlap between them. And I don't think we know exactly the extent, because we've almost certainly got under ascertainment of both. And the evidence that we have comes from surgical kind of settings, and that's really, really tricky. But I think it is really important to be thinking critically about it, because if you miss adenomyosis, if you're doing surgical treatment for endometriosis, then that might be a reason why people have got ongoing pelvic pain or pelvic bleeding. And vice versa, it might inform the type of treatment that you want to offer or that you want to think about or that you talk about. Now, that's going to involve probably some liaison with a specialist. But from a GP perspective, I think just being aware that there can be coexistence, but it can also both exist discreetly. So it's a little bit complicated. Actually, the same is true for fibroids. So there is some evidence that where people have got both fibroids and adenomyosis, that heavy bleeding and pain is more significant where there's adenomyosis there as well. So again, those kind of overlaps.
And then, as you rightly say, it's kind of treating the symptom. So whether it's abnormal bleeding or heavy bleeding or pain is predominant, and then matching the sort of treatment, initial primary care management to those symptoms.
Absolutely. So there are the kind of non-contraceptive, if you like, options or non-hormonal options that can be helpful and are definitely worth trying. So tranexamic acid, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, mefenamic acid, a bit careful with renal function, naproxen, if they're not contraindicated, if they're tolerated, as we're all really comfortable and familiar with doing. Hormonal options are interesting because I think there's nothing that's licensed specifically for adenomyosis. And to the best of my knowledge, almost no trials that are specifically around it. So this is very pragmatic and symptom focused, but in a sense, that's, I guess, our strength as GPs and what we're used to. So you manage the symptoms as you would, and we refer on if our symptomatic management doesn't get somebody to a point where they're comfortable or confident, or where they are happy to carry on as they are. So if people are happy with hormonal treatment, then the progestogen that's been best studied, I think, is Dianogest, but it's not one I use, or vaginal danazol. Again, nothing licensed and nothing very specific. So I think we would probably use norethisterone or desogestrel, combined hormonal contraception, if it's not contraindicated and can be really helpful. And if they manage pain and they are successfully managing bleeding, then that's what's important. The RUS, so hormonal coil, relatively well studied and is a really good for somebody who wants contraception or is happy to have contraception and is happy to have an intrauterine system. Then there is reasonable evidence in relatively small cohorts, but has been studied in adenomyosis and can help with both pain and bleeding. There was a really pragmatic study in UK primary care about heavy menstrual bleeding, not specifically looking at adenomyosis, that also speaks to the acceptability and tolerability quite long term of primary care interventions for heavy menstrual bleeding. So I think, you know, those are things that are quite helpful. There is possibility of higher expulsion rates, but I don't know how certain that is. But just saying to someone, you know, as you would for anybody, this might work, it might help, but come and tell me if you have any trouble with it. I think the really important thing, though, and I think this is symptom based, is if what we are able to offer doesn't relieve someone's worries or concerns or their symptoms, then that's where we need to be just working with our secondary care colleagues and referring to gynecology and thinking about working with them for some personalized support. Some of the more specialized things they might do might include GnRH analogues for menstrual suppression. If you're using that for more than 6 months, you need to think about whether you can use ADBAC HRT. Again, there's nothing licensed for that, but that is something that I think might perhaps change as we're seeing oral versions of that licensed in endometriosis, but they're not licensed in adenomyosis to the best of my knowledge at the moment. There is increasing interest in some specialist or minimally invasive surgical techniques. Again, that would be kind of a really specialist thing that wouldn't be our decision to make, but there is a bit of evidence for uterine artery embolization or minimally invasive thermal ablation procedures. But again, the safety and the evidence and the risk of emergency hysterectomy, for example, that might be there with some of those. They're obviously really, really specialist interventions, but that would need to be a personalised decision with that person, depending on what their priorities and future wishes might be around that. Things like just removing bits of adenomyosis is something that people are trying, but I think it's not really outside a research setting at the moment. And of course, ultimately, hysterectomy is a good treatment for isolated adenomyosis, but that's where thinking really carefully about looking for coexistent endometriosis at the same time and thinking about what that means for treatment is important.
Absolutely. And you rightly say the sort of individualized nature, so age of the patient, where they are in their thoughts about fertility or children, how is this impacting their symptoms? Is it pain or bleeding or periods? How is that impacting on their school, work, college, etc., home life? And making a sort of personalized plan, I guess, which all of us would try to do. And I guess, as you say, reassess that and see what impacts and get advice if you've tried a few things in primary care and not working.
Yeah, or if there are any red flags. I mean, I think this is tricky around things like maybe with hormone therapies in perimenopause and menopause, and you might then end up with a scan that raises uncertainty about assessing the endometrium fully. And in that case, obviously, you know, you just need to refer on for further input and further tests to make sure that this is all safe. But in my experience anyway, that's like a not uncommon thing that happens, and that's quite an important thing just to be aware of.
Yeah, as you note, any sort of worrying features on the scan or depending on the age of the patient as well, if you're concerned.
And I think the other group are there's this kind of possible adenomyosis like reporting in adolescents. But if I saw an abnormal ultrasound scan or this type of report in adolescents, I would be asking for specialist advice because, again, it's just a little bit complicated. Also, I guess, if you were doing an ultrasound scan in an adolescent, you would be doing that if you were aware that they had really difficult symptoms. So I think if I then got a scan back that reported this, I would be asking for specialist advice because findings that look like adenomyosis can be reported in teenagers, but it's relatively rare and it just needs a bit of specialist unpicking, that I would say.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Thinking about next steps, sounds like a lot more research needed in this area, maybe some clinical guidelines.
We say finishing by saying we need to know more, but actually we really do. I think it's a fascinating and critically important question. What it really shows is that as we get technologies or advances in understanding that make us realise that we have to reappraise what had been known or believed about a condition, we need to be agile and we really, really need to be listening to the people with the condition. And I think I'm really grateful to the people who have spoken out about their experience of adenomyosis, how much difficulty it has caused them, and for them leading the way. And it's just quite a fast-changing thing. So I think we do need to know more about population prevalence, and we need evidence that is specific to adenomyosis, and we need primary care, pragmatic trials and pragmatic evidence. But we have got quite good symptom-based pragmatic evidence and pragmatic trials. I don't think we need to despair, but it would be helpful, I think, if it was pulled together a little bit by NICE, although the heavy menstrual bleeding guidance does give really helpful advice about how to support heavy bleeding, including where adenomyosis might be there and when to can think about it. So, yeah, to pull it together would be helpful, perhaps.
And then other resources. So obviously within the college, we've got our online learning resources. So we've got some podcasts and material on endometriosis. I think this is the first adenomyosis topic we've done, so that's really good. And we covered a little bit about the overlap on there. But any other sort of top tips for resources that you might signpost people to?
The RCGP e-learning on heavy menstrual bleeding is really, really helpful, and NICE clinical knowledge summaries for GPs I find really, really helpful. So as a GP, that's where I go to, and I find that super helpful. For patients, Endometriosis UK has got some good resources. There's an advocacy organisation called the Adeno Gang that I'm aware of. Wellbeing of Women have got people's stories and resources about adenomyosis, and they've also got a period symptom checker that can help people make sense of what they're experiencing with their periods, and that then gives them a letter to come to the GP that can be super helpful.
That's really helpful. Thank you, Sharon. And I should flag, we also co-wrote an article on adenomyosis and top tips for GPs in the BJGP, which some people might find helpful, and we can post a link with this podcast. Just to think about reflecting back any top tips into clinical practice for GPs.
I think we've touched on the clinical management questions. I guess there is a really interesting question about having some guidance about coding it and what gets coded from ultrasounds, because I think, you know, with increasingly using GP records as a source of understanding and knowledge development, if we could have some guidance on making sure codes for adenomyosis on ultrasound or an understanding of when we should code it and not, will help people like you and I when we're trying to do research to understand outcomes and what happens and how often these things are. I mean, that's not the same as a population study, because of course we don't do ultrasounds in a population. We do ultrasounds because somebody's got symptoms that mean that an ultrasound is clinically justified or indicated. But I guess some clarity about coding and recording in the notes might help some real world knowledge development. And I think that's possibly the researcher in me, but except that I think it would be a potentially really helpful opportunity to try and develop understanding in the world about how often it happens and what you can do.
And like we've touched on, it's that symptom approach, seeing what's important to the patient. I would say, like, it's not the scan that we're treating, it's that person, isn't it, and their symptoms and how that's impacting them, and when we might refer based on the response to the treatment we offer in primary care.
Yes, but I think it can be really important to people. I think it would be also really helpful to gather up more people's stories about what mm-hmm. their adenomyosis journey has been like and what their experience has been like and what's been important to them, particularly around their experiences of talking to GPs and healthcare, because that also is, I think, such an important way of how we can learn as doctors about what questions we should be asking and what we can do better. And I think this might also be something where things like women's health hubs could be hugely helpful. And then you get that kind of bilateral learning where you learn from what happens with your patients and your patients teach us. But a kind of holding this care in collaboration between primary and secondary care to try and learn as much as we can about getting it right. And I guess the last thing I would say is we've talked a lot about heavy painful bleeding. So we just need to remember treating anemia and testing for it and remembering how important that can be to how people feel.
That's great. Thank you so much again, Sharon, for talking about adenomyosis and a little bit about the overlap with endometriosis. As we've said, please do have a look at the college website. There's some really good tools and resources on there. Our BJGP article, also Endometriosis UK. And I think you've done some work with them. Is that right?
Yep, I'm on their medical advisory panel. And Wellbeing of Women also, and AdenoGang. Those are just some of the ones I know. There'll doubtless be many more. And I'm really always so appreciative of those advocacy and support organisations that are just so important to being part of supporting people.
Thank you very much for listening, and thank you for tuning in to RCGP podcasts. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. Hope to speak to you soon.